This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, the Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Step back in time to the winter of 1929, where the magic of Christmas in Brooklyn, New York, was shattered by a heinous act that reverberated through the ages. In The Murder of Mary Falzone, a shocking true crime story, Rod Cackley unravels the chilling tale of a family torn apart by an explosion that claimed the lives of Mary, Philip, and Rose Falzone, innocent children whose lives were extinguished by a bomb disguised as a holiday gift. As the city grappled with the aftermath of this unspeakable tragedy, a relentless investigation unfolded to unmask the perpetrators behind the merciless attack. Rod Cackley takes readers on a gripping journey through the dark alleys of 1920s Brooklyn, where organized crime thrived and the thin line between justice and retribution blurred. The narrative unfolds like a suspenseful thriller, capturing the tension of a city on the brink. Through painstaking research and vivid storytelling, Rod Cackley paints a vivid picture of a bygone era, immersing readers in the sights, sounds, and emotions of a community grappling with grief and the quest for justice. As the investigation deepens, readers will be engrossed by the cast of characters, dedicated detectives, grieving family members, and the shadowy figures lurking in the criminal underworld. The book unveils the layers of deception and betrayal that led to that fateful December morning, keeping readers on the edge of their seats with every revelation. The Murder of Mary Falzone transcends the true crime genre, becoming a poignant exploration of the enduring quest for justice and the impact of violence on a family and a community. This is a tale that goes beyond the headlines, inviting readers to contemplate the fragility of life and the strength that can emerge in the face of tragedy. Gripping, evocative, and profoundly moving, this true crime narrative is a must-read for those seeking an unforgettable journey into the heart of a dark chapter in American history. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Murder of Mary Falzone, a shocking true crime story, with my special guest, author Rod Cackley. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview. Rod Cackley.
Hi, good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this interview.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You take us in the murder of Mary Falzone, a shocking true crime story. Certainly is. You take us to October 4th, 1929, and in an apartment on the outskirts of Brooklyn, New York. And a 19-year-old, you say, a hulking 19-year-old and his older accomplice in his early 30s. And these people are drafting a letter. The 19-year-old is drafting a letter, and they have in the letter, you say, somebody in their crosshairs. Tell us about this letter writing duo and what they are writing about before you tell me or tell our audience exactly what they have drafted in that letter and who are they are sending it to.
Sure. Yeah, we've got a 19-year-old, as you said, with a penchant for intimidation. His accomplice, I write, is a seasoned brute in his early 30s with a demeanor as weathered as his scuffed leather boots. These guys are partners, but not friends, okay? They don't care for each other much, but they're joined in this mutual business, if you will, of intimidating people and extorting money. Now, they have set their sights to begin now on a guy by the name of Joseph Falzone. He's a rich Sicilian immigrant, very well-to-do. He owns, with a partner, he owns a marble contracting company. They really specialize in tombstones, ironically enough. And they made $300,000 in profit last year, which is in 1928, which is, we're talking several million dollars in today's money. And living in Brooklyn, New York now, this is October 4th, 1929. The date is important because right now, for the past 10 years, living in Brooklyn is a license to print money. The factories are humming. The waterfront is bustling with activity every day. Coney Island was jammed last summer, and it should be next season, too. At least that's what they think. Money is everywhere, and this guy, this 19-year-old, wants his unfair share. He's a high school graduate, a rarity in 1929, and right now he's at a chipped, scratched wooden desk in his buddy's apartment, the 30-year-old, hard at work scribbling out a letter. He's wearing a well-worn tweed suit featuring a jacket just a bit too small for his large, muscular frame. He's got a thin tie hanging loosely around his neck, a dingy white shirt unbuttoned to the collar, and right now he's on his fourth attempt to get the wording of this letter just right. He's using a fountain pen, and if you've ever used a fountain pen, we don't use them much anymore, but they've got a nub on the front, on the tip, and he's doing his best, or the nib, doing his best not to crush it into the paper. At the same time, he's writing, he's pressing hard enough on this paper, it's like the paper owes him money. He's trying to get this right the fourth time out, and he's doing more now than just extorting money. He wants this guy, the target of his letter, to leave Brooklyn. So he writes, "If you don't leave this city within 30 days, you will hear from us. You are a sneak, and we, with a sneak, are going to cut the head." This is what he wrote, okay? And what he means to write is the snake, but he wrote this with a sneak, and we are going to cut the head. Be quick to send if you value your life and that of your wife, and that's all. We won't sign surname, not because we're afraid, but just because you are a rat. And he turns to his partner and says, "That's great, isn't it?" You know, the partner really couldn't care less. He just wants to get this done. Now, back in 1929, when gangs ran out of money, they kidnapped and they extorted. It was a quick way to print money, if you will. And that's what these guys are doing right here, is they're trying to get money and get money fast. But the 19-year-old, now there's a reason he wants his target to leave town. And I don't know if you want to talk about that right now, but there is a reason that he wants more from money, or more than money from this guy, Dan.
Let's get to... We opened at October 4th, 1929, and this letter was drafted that day. Certainly, the target received that in a certain amount of time, within a week or so. But you take us in the story to October 23rd, 1929, and these guys are talking about not getting a response from that letter that they had drafted.
They can't believe it. The 19-year-old is totally flummoxed. He cannot believe that this Sicilian businessman, this immigrant, has not even responded to the letter. The older man, the guy in his 30s, he's ready to do whatever it takes, but he's not getting excited about too much. The 19-year-old, though, says we need to get more explicit and give this man a better idea of what will happen if he ignores the ultimatum. And so he writes another letter in which he writes, so you've come back again, skunk. I thought you'd gone. Maybe you think that in the last letter I wrote you, I was fooling. But listen, you rat, and get this straight. If you don't do as I ask in the last letter, you know what to expect. Since you couldn't get that straight, get this straight. Friday, you are to get on the boat for Boston, which leaves Friday, October 25 at 6 p.m., Pier 14. You are to get on this boat alone. You are to have with you $6,000 in cash, American money, all in $20 bills, wrapped in plain brown paper. You will be informed what to do with the package when you are on the boat. Remember, this does not mean you are paying for your liberty. You will have 13 days to leave the country. So he's upping the ante here, obviously. And I should say that when I get the story, the letters, mainly out of newspaper accounts from that day. This is how it was reported. This is where I'm getting it from, the way he's writing the letter.
Absolutely. Now, you take us just a couple days later, October 25th, 1929. And so you say that they're meeting at 8 p.m. There's no sign of their mark. And so they wonder what went wrong. They contemplate what went wrong. And you say that there was a incredible moment in history that was occurring at the same time, especially in New York.
Yeah, right. Exactly. This is the crash of Wall Street. And so our 19-year-old here, now the boat we're talking about, the boat from Boston to New York, these boats would go back and forth. It was really the most efficient way to travel between the two cities. So right. There were many boats going back and forth. And the 19-year-old is thinking, you know, his mark has not shown up with the cash. He's wondering if the guy got on the wrong boat, if he was ignoring him, or just simply made a mistake. But at the same time, this is the crash. This is when the newspapers are reporting that business people are jumping out of their windows. They have no idea how bad it's going to get. But it's bad enough that he's thinking that this businessman, maybe he jumped out a window. So they really don't know where to go next.
So what's their next step to try to determine what had happened?
Well, their next step is to write another letter. Oh, well, but they decide to up the ante, too. They're going to make it clear to this guy that they're not messing around. They put together a pipe bomb and wrap it in put it inside a Christmas package and take it to the target's home.
You take us to December 8th, 1929, and Jenny Falzone, the wife, is struggling to get her five children ready for her 15-year-old daughter, Mary Falzone's first communion. It's a big deal. The family has to be at St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church before 9 a.m., and it's 8:20 a.m., and Joseph, her husband, has promised to be there for that first communion. And so she's busy getting the kids ready. She's bemoaning the fact that he's not around. He has said he is on one of his numerous hunting trips with his friends, but he assured her he would be back. Tell us what happens with Jenny and the children and getting them ready for this first communion.
Yeah, Jenny is struggling to get her daughter, her oldest daughter, Mary, into her communion dress. They have not many, they don't have long. As you said, it's about 8:20 in the morning. They have to get to the church before 9 a.m. to get this communion going. This happens to be a rather warm day in December, warmer than they usually have in Brooklyn. That's where the home is, in Brooklyn. Not a drop of rain is falling, not a flake of snow. It's really a spring day. As a matter of fact, New Yorkers are out playing golf. They have been yesterday, and they will be again today. But Jenny doesn't care about that. What she's interested in is getting her kids together. She's upstairs in the bedroom with Mary. Peter, Rose, she's with Mary, also with the youngest kids, Patrick and Sally. Now, Peter and Rose and Mary, the three middle-aged, Peter and Rose are down in the kitchen. She hears noise. Jenny hears a lot of noise downstairs. She's wondering what's going on. She's got two choices here. Either she can stay with Mary and get her dressed, or she can go downstairs and find out what all the noise is about. She decides to stay upstairs with Mary and get her in her dress. Now, as he said, Joseph is not there. The husband, the father, is not there. He's promised, he put his hand, literally put his right hand on a Bible, promising that he would be home for Mary's communion. But so far, no, he's not there. So she's doing this all on her own. Finally, she goes downstairs. Mary gets downstairs in her white communion dress. Philip and Rose look at her, not because of the dress, but Mary's eyes also grow wide as saucers when she spots the source of all the noise from downstairs. On the kitchen table in the middle of the kitchen is an ornately decorated package wrapped with bright Christmas paper, ribbons, and bows, and bound with a string. All three kids, Mary, Peter, and Rose, gather around the table, jumping up and down. They're excited as any kid would be with a mysterious Christmas package mysteriously appearing on their kitchen table.
Well, the thing is that they're looking at that Christmas, looks like a Christmas present. In their minds, what do the children, you can only suppose, but what were they thinking this present on December 8th might be?
They're thinking their father might have dropped the package off. First off, the house was locked. So, you know, kids don't think like this, but how did the package get there? So they're thinking, and Jenny, when she comes downstairs with Patrick and Sally, the two youngest kids, she's thinking that maybe Joseph put this Christmas package on the table as a present or had it sent over as a way of apologizing for being late this morning. So she allows the kids to jump around in the kitchen and try to open the package. They pull a string and it explodes. There was a pipe bomb inside this package. It explodes. And it is just a pipe bomb of death. Iron and steel slugs rip through the kitchen. The concussion of the blast rips through the kitchen. The children and Mary, Peter, and Rose are grievously injured.
You say this blast is right outside and has an effect on the, literally, the skin of this Giuseppe Di Benedetto's, his body.
Yeah, and the blast shards. Yeah, the blast wave is incredible. This is an incredible bomb. Now, this is in the kitchen, okay? It destroys the kitchen. The ice box, the stove, they're destroyed. The kids are literally blown to pieces. Mary and Peter are killed instantly. Rose is still breathing. Jenny, Patrick, and Sally all suffer concussion. They were not actually at the table. They were kind of in the hallway off the kitchen. They saw what happened, but they are blown back. But yeah, there's a taxi driver, Giuseppe Di Benedetto. He's in a taxi that happens to be driving by the house when it explodes. The windows on the right side of his taxi are blown out. He feels the concussion of the blast, and he's outside. Now, windows in the neighborhood, houses in the neighborhood lose their windows. The concussion is so extreme that it blows the windows out of houses. It blows the windows out of cars parked across the street. This is an incredible explosion.
Now, right away, you say that Giuseppe runs in and grabs the two children, the two younger children, then comes back for Jenny. They seem to be okay. And then right away, of course, the police are called. And you say they're contingent of people, including people associated with the mayor, the district attorney, and people are soon at this bombed out home, aren't they?
Yeah. Giuseppe was in the World War, what we call now the First World War, but back then was just the World War or the Great War. Giuseppe was in the war, so he's familiar with the concept of triage and wounded people. He immediately goes to the mother, Jenny, and the two youngest kids, Patrick and Sally, and gets them out of the house because in terms of triage, they are the most likely, they do not need as much attention as anyone else. He goes back in the kitchen then, and he looks at Mary and Peter and realizes they're gone. They're dead. There's nothing that he can do for them. But Rose is still alive and breathing, so he struggles to get her out of the house. At the same time, as you said, now this is Brooklyn. This is a very nice upscale neighborhood in Brooklyn. And neighbors from blocks away are coming over to find out what's going on. And at the same time, city officials are showing up right away. As I write in the book, Joseph Falzone, the husband here, he's not a nobody. Okay, this guy's got money. This guy's got power. This guy's got influence. And all of a sudden, police officials, the mayor shows up. Jenny looks around and realizes there have never been so many Irish in this Sicilian Italian neighborhood before, and they're all on her front lawn.
You say that picking through the rubble, this Inspector Sullivan, who heads up this team of investigators, discovers an alarm clock, a spring, and a 6-volt battery.
Right. John J. Sullivan is a very interesting guy who was destined to rise in the NYPD and the New York Police Department. He takes the lead of all the Irish cops on the scene. He takes the lead in this, and he goes into the house and he finds the kitchen is absolutely destroyed. There's really nothing left. Really, he finds, as you said, he finds the alarm clock. He realizes right away that when the children pulled the string, he heard from Giuseppe and the kids who survived that the string was pulled. That didn't have anything to do with his bomb going off. The reason the bomb went off is it was timed. There was a clock in there and it was timed to go out. This obviously was put together by a professional. They knew what they were doing, Sullivan decides. So the cops descend into the kitchen while taking Rose on the stretcher to Wyckoff Heights Hospital, hoping that she will survive. Jenny is outside with her two surviving kids, Patrick and Sally, and it's a manic scene, as you can imagine. So Sullivan's in the house with all the cops, and suddenly, guess what? The phone rings. The phone is still working. And who's on the phone? It's Joseph Falzone. He's saying he's in Brooklyn. He's on his way back. He just wanted to say hello to the family and assure them that he was going to be back and at the church. Well, Sullivan is suspicious right away. I mean, why would, out of the blue, Falzone call? Why would he stop and call? Why wouldn't he just come to the house? Remember, Joseph Falzone is the only surviving family member here who wasn't hurt by this explosion. And he calls out of the blue. Well, they tell him what's happened. And so he says, I'll be right there. At the same time, Sullivan looks around and he hears a bird singing. There's a bird singing, a canary. There's a canary in a cage in the kitchen. Not hurt. Absolutely not hurt. This canary survived and was not injured at all. And Sullivan just can't believe it.
Now, Sullivan is very interested, along with the other police, but Sullivan is very interested to see Joseph's reaction when he comes to the site of this bombing and finds out about his dead children. So what is his reaction and what does Sullivan note?
Sullivan, as you said, is very interested in going on. And Sullivan asks him, where are you? He talked to him on the phone and told him to get down right away. When Falzone, rather, comes in the kitchen, he's still wearing his khaki hunting outfit. He's got a double-barreled shotgun in the crook of his arm, and he strides into the house like a man who knows he's supposed to be there. He still has burrs and stick tights in his clothing, his hands and face scratched by briars, his beard badly needing a shave to scrape off a 4 days worth of growth. His eyes bounce around the kitchen. He can't believe what's going on. His response, what does Joseph do? He raises that double-barreled shotgun in his clenched fist and with furious anger swears a terrible vengeance upon the killer of his children. A slow, painful death, he says, even worse than what happened to his offspring. Detectives still don't believe him, though. They see him as the number one suspect here.
Now, what does he tell him about his experience with receiving letters from this Black Hand gang?
He tells Sullivan and the other detectives that he goes outside and collapses, too. We should say that. He goes outside on the front lawn and just collapses. It takes a couple of the strongest detectives to pick him up and put him in the car. He immediately starts talking about the threatening letters he's been receiving from what he describes as the notorious Black Hand Gang. Now, the Black Hand Gang was big back in the day. I don't know if you saw Godfather 2, the movie, but you'll remember one of the characters in there was supposedly connected with the Black Hand Gang. And this is what we're talking about here. The Black Hand in the movie Godfather 2, you remember the Black Hand guy, he preyed upon Italians and Sicilians in America. That's exactly what the Black Hand gang was doing in real life. And that is, Joseph Falzone figures the letters he's getting must be from Black Hand, because as I cite in the book, there are several other cases of the Black Hand extorting Sicilian and Italian immigrants, especially business people who obviously had money. So that's what he's telling them right away, is he's been getting these letters threatening letters, extorting money, and he refused to give any money.
They're also looking, this Detective Carroll believes that maybe a couple of the employees at this marble company, this might be involved in this blackmailing operation as well. So they look into that.
Right. Yeah, there are a couple of employees that he thinks that might be at the marble contracting company, Columbia, that might be involved in this too. But if I can get back to Black Hand, for instance, for a minute, again, with Godfather 2, the head of this Black Hand gang that they're looking at, I was never able to find his name in any of the research I did. But what was clear there was his front company was an olive oil importing business, just like in Godfather. Okay. I just thought that was really interesting, that connection there. So, yeah, now Falzone lays out, he tells him about the first message he got, the letters that we talked about. But now they're looking at the Columbia Marble Works Company, too. And they believe there are a couple of people there who've got scrupulous backgrounds and are bad backgrounds, and they might have been in on this as well.
There's also the issue, and they believe this could be a possible motivation. They ask, who is May Storer?
Yeah, and this is where it gets really interesting. You know, what they do after the explosion, they take Joseph and Jenny right away to the police station. And what do Joseph and Jenny, two grieving parents, do? They go wild on each other. They start screaming and yelling at each other. And the reason is Joseph has been cheating on Jenny, made no secret. Well, he did make a secret of it until his mistress got in touch with Jenny and told her all about it, and also told her that she's pregnant. So Jenny is loaded for bear when she gets Joseph in this interrogation. They put him in the same interrogation room, which is an interesting thing to do. And these two just unload on each other. Finally, Sullivan realizes they're speaking in Italian, cursing at each other in Italian. Joseph can't, John T. Sullivan, the chief inspector in this case, he can't understand a word they're saying, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that these two are at each other's throats. So if for no other reason than to keep their main suspect alive, they put Joseph and Jenny in separate interrogation rooms, and Jenny just spills the beans on everything. And she names the mistress May Storer and even gives them the address.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The house where she lives, May, and she knows that because May has been sending her letters. And she has been intercepting letters that May sent as well to Joseph. And where she put them? Under the linoleum in her kitchen. So we've got this track record. There's a paper trail of Joseph and his mistress. and the fact that Joseph knows she's pregnant.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages. Now, we have the motivation of this mistress, but to be fair, a wealthy Italian Sicilian businessman at that time, not so unusual to have a mistress either.
Oh, right. And especially in that day and age, believe me, they were, you know, not just Italian businessmen, but, you know, one thing I point to in this story is I try to give you some real context about everything that was happening and what it was like to live in those days and the salacious affairs that were, you know, we think that in our media today, anything goes. Well, it really was back in those days when there were a lot more newspapers competing with each other for a reader's attention and their, you know, pennies that they were paying for the newspaper. So these salacious affairs, you know, this was not real news, but they were wondering, the cops had to wonder, how was this another motivation for Joseph to plant this pipe bomb?
Mm-hmm.
Orchid may have done it, yeah.
Getting back to Joseph as well, is that he says, he continues with the letters that were sent to him via what he says the Black Hand Gang, and with the instructions about going on the boat to Boston and having the $6,000 with him in $20 bills. But he says that he didn't follow, he contacted the police. This is interesting. The police are talking to Joseph, and he says, well, I contacted the police at that time. And I worked with the detective Carroll, but I got the directions wrong.
Right. So, yeah. So just as the 19-year-old blackmailer thought, he did get the directions wrong. He wound up on the wrong boat. And he had been working with the police. He did go to the police, this detective Carroll. So Sullivan brings Carroll into the room, into the interrogation room. And Detective Carroll confirms everything that Falzone has been saying. So now they're backing away from Joseph Falzone as a suspect.
Now, the thing is that there are reports of Falzone 3 hours before the explosion. A restaurant owner witness comes forward. And tell us about this witness and a couple other witnesses that give information to the police that send them in a different direction.
Yeah, this is now, we're talking about the same time frame. This is all very close to the day of the explosion. But they do have a restaurant owner on Wyckoff Avenue, a few blocks from Falzone's home, who swears he saw Joe Falzone 3 hours before the explosion. A second cop said, that's one cop says that, gives that advice to or information to Sullivan. So there's no way that Falzone could have been traveling home from a hunting trip when the bomb went off. Two taxi drivers say they saw a guy matching Joseph's description outside the Falzone home at 5:30 a.m. the morning of the bombing. So again, we're looking at, so they've caught Falzone, they believe, in a couple of lies. An rock-solid eyewitness who places him at the restaurant on Wyckoff when the bomb went off, and another, two taxi drivers who say they saw him outside of the house before the bomb went off. So now Falzone's got to find some collaboration for his alibi, and he brings in three of his buddies, Philip Goebel, Benjamin, and Philip Goldman, all from Mineola, and another guy by the name of Edward Frida, and he lives at 126 Irving Avenue. These four are grilled separately by the toughest cops in the house. All four say they spent several days tromping through the woods of Pike County, Pennsylvania. They all slept in one room of a hunting lodge and came back to New York with Joseph yesterday. So they are disputing the witnesses who say they saw Joseph in the diner and outside the house.
There's a witness, though, that says they're looking again simultaneously, just like as the police should. But they're looking again at the marble company that Joseph Falzone headed up. And they see that there are a couple people that the witness corroborates that they had seen them in the area as well. Tell us about this witness's testimony.
Yeah, Joseph gives Sullivan the names of three Black Hand gang members who he believes might be tied to this plot. And there's one other angle Sullivan's detectives are working on. Jenny tells them the first of the Black Hand blackmail notes received. So they're really looking at this Black Hand. They're looking at the Black Hand, and they want to talk to another Sicilian concerning the murder of, they're looking at other murders now and looking for connections. Okay, there have been other pipe bombs. There have been other murders. They're trying to find a connection. And they look at one guy by the name of Harry Ruizzi. He works at the marble company, the Columbia Marble Company. And they're thinking he now is one of the prime suspects. And there's another guy, Severa Fioria, who has experience in demolitions from the Great War.
And when they have these people in their sight, there is a witness that says that they, that Ruizzi is sighted with a, alongside another person.
Yeah, Frank Simone Jr. Is that who you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah, Frank Simone Jr., who is the son of Joseph Falzone's partner. Okay, this gets kind of like really complicated here. But, and by the way, and after the funeral, they buried the three children. And Falzone retires at that point from his marble company. But yeah, his partner, Frank Simone, has a son, Frank Simone Jr., and he becomes a suspect in this now. So you, and he, because he was seen with Harry Ruizzi and Severa Piori.
And you talk about what happens, again, we were skipping over some things, this incredible funeral where they have the three children in three white caskets and hundreds of people and nothing but police looking for potentially the killers to come and be present at this funeral, remarkably. They
it's
also
a very emotional scene, too. Jenny, the mother, collapses. Joseph has to carry her back to one of the cars in the funeral procession. It's a very emotional scene.
And you're right, too, that the Falzone is devastated. Not only does he not neglect himself, but he neglects the surviving members of the family. He's a shadow of himself. The wife continues to just put his meals at his door. He's not eating. He's not sleeping. He is racked with incredible amount of guilt. So anybody suspecting him of being complicit in this might think otherwise when they see what he has become.
Yeah, and that's exactly the conclusion that the inspector, John J. Sullivan, comes to. He sees him a couple, now if we can fast forward a couple of years to June 1931. So it's been a couple of years, no one's been arrested yet. Falzone is still kind of a suspect, but then Sullivan sees him. He comes, Falzone goes into his office, and Sullivan sees that he is not the man that he saw 2 years ago. As you said, he has hardly eaten in 2 years. He hardly ever sleeps. It's guilt. It's the inability to seek vengeance. This guy, Falzone, is just wasted. He is a shadow of what he used to be. So Sullivan now really begins looking for other suspects. He's kind of written Falzone off that suspect list.
So how do they continue with their investigation, and where does their break come?
They start following Frank Simone Jr., Harry Ruizzi, and Severa Piori. They start following the three of them because they seem to be their top suspects. October 29, 1931, just about 2 years have passed since the bombing, and the two who orchestrated the deadly attack are becoming increasingly suspicious of each other. Now, so you've got Frank Simone Jr. and Harry Ruizzi. Frank Simone Jr. is that 19-year-old we talked about. Harry Ruizzi is the older, bigger guy in his early 30s, and they now are starting to become suspicious of each other. Sullivan's got a feeling that that's the wedge he can work between them. So they put an undercover cop on the payroll at Columbia Marble Works, a guy by the name of Henry. He's a friendly German who just happens to speak fluent Italian. Now he starts hanging out with Frank and Harry, kind of never, sometimes together, but he tries to be separately with them too. So he can kind of, this is a great undercover cop story too, where Henry points to the older, he's talking to the younger guy, Frank, and he points over to Harry and says, he's a great guy, isn't he? And Frank says, I'm glad you think so, but I think he's a snake. You don't like him? I hate him, Frank says. So he's got this wedge now. Henry says, walk with me. I need to tell you something, when he's with Frank. So they know they've got this wedge now between Frank and Harry.
Right.
And he's walking with Henry, and he walks him right into a police car. And a couple of the biggest cops you can find on the NYPD jump out of the car, and they say, Frank Simone Jr., you are under arrest. And get this, your buddy's a squealer. He put all the blame on you. So now they're putting Henry against Frank and Frank against Henry. And you've got a couple of other cops involved in this now, too. Remember, this is 2 years down the road. So you've got Captain McGowan, Detectives Carroll, who we talked about before, and Detective Dardis. And Henry is an undercover cop. That's what Frank realizes when Henry grabs him by the collar, by the neck of his shirt, and throws him into the car.
Yeah, so it's very typical. Both perpetrators are blaming each other, but very much like the not-so-intelligent criminals, there is more evidence against the 19-year-old, and obviously more motivation to be the letter writer of this Scamone Jr., Frank Scamone Jr. But they also investigate whether the father, the actual silent partner of Joseph Falzone, was involved in this plot to blackmail.
Yeah, they do. They investigate the father as well and find there's no connection at all. What happened was Scamone Jr., Frank, he remember we said that he wanted more than money and he wanted to get Falzone out of the country? That's because he wanted a partnership at the marble company. He not only wanted money, he wanted power. Because he knew, too, the power it would give him in the Italian community if he was a partner at the table at Columbia Marble. So he wanted in. Now, yeah, as you're saying, they've got a lot of evidence against Frank. They're also looking at the Severa Priore because it seems that he's the one who actually put the bomb together. So they've got him, too. So you've got three suspects involved in this. Frank and Severa are more experienced at this than Frank is. Frank's only a 19-year-old, remember. He's just a couple of years out of high school. He's a kid, basically, compared to these other two. So they put them in separate interrogation rooms, as you might imagine, trying to turn one against the other. Harry and Severa know how this game is played, so they immediately turn on Frank and tell everything about Frank.
Now, in these confessions, the horrible truth about how this was done, how they got in the home, the actual plot itself, why there was a bomb that went off and killed what looked like it was going to kill everybody at a breakfast table because this man wasn't paying his tribute to this Black Hand gang. Tell us what is ascertained from this about what actually happened that morning and why.
Yeah, it's Luisi sighs and opens up. It's time to tell everything. He's with the cops now. He says, "We never meant to kill nobody." Eyes on the floor, not wanting to look at anyone in the eye. He says, "We broke into the Falzone house at 2 a.m. Everybody was asleep. The bomb was supposed to go off before they woke up and came downstairs, not when those poor little kids were around it. Scamone did it so he could scare Falzone away from Columbia Marble," says Ruisi. "When the letters didn't work, he put the bomb together at his brother-in-law Severa Priori's place on Flushing Avenue." So Priori wasn't home when Frank put the bomb together. He just wanted a place to build the bomb where he wouldn't be interrupted by his wife. And besides, Severa had all the tools he needed since he was an electrician. So now we've got another character in here, Edward Mulrooney, the new police commissioner in New York. He's in on this. This is a huge story in New York. He doesn't believe Severa is innocent, and as much as the trio of uniformed cops standing in the hallway believe he is, neither of these idiots, Scamone or Ruisi, knows enough about making a bomb to do a professional job like this, Mulrooney says. Priori must have been in on it. So now they've got Priori. Now they're really convinced they've got three main suspects here. Frank Scamone Jr., Harry Ruisi, and Severa Priori. And they're looking at all three, and they're trying to turn all three against each other. And it turns out what happens is Harry and Severa, they work a plea bargain. And so they become state's witnesses, I guess you could say.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear from our sponsor. You know, just like most of you listening, I find myself every day juggling many responsibilities, including work and family duties and shopping and meals and social events. And there's never enough just me time or enough time period to even try something else to deal with the daily stress. So I start my morning with Ritual Stress Relief. This product uses first-of-its-kind technology to support the body's natural cortisol response so you can take on your own daily juggle. I decided to start using Ritual Stress Relief because I've been successfully taking Ritual's innovative multivitamin and their Symbiotic Plus for years. And I trusted Ritual to deliver yet again another great product to deal with daily stress. Stress Relief BioSeries technology is designed to optimize the release of a trio of clinically studied ingredients to help the body manage stress. Ashwagandha has been clinically studied to support normal cortisol levels and reduce stress. L-theanine is clinically studied to provide quick stress relief within the hour and a non-drowsy sense of calm. Saffron is clinically studied to promote a positive mood and reduce stress. Ritual suggests taking Stress Relief in the morning when cortisol is typically at its peak to support the body's natural cortisol response with an instant and extended release formulation for all-day support. The juggle is real. Don't just respond to stress. Get ahead of it with Stress Relief from Ritual. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/murder. Start Ritual or add Stress Relief to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/murder for 25% off. Now, you say this is a huge story, and at the same time, there is a possibility of a death penalty in Brooklyn, in New York. So tell us what the choice, what the discussion is about in terms of the most humane way to die in New York.
Oh, yeah. This is, you know, Frank. Now, they, Harry and Severa, they turn on Frank. Okay. They do a plea bargain, in essence. And so it's all on Frank now. He's up on first degree murder. He's charged with first degree murder. And he's deathly afraid of heading to Sing Sing's, the Sing Sing prison's electric chair. You know, this electric chair, it doesn't work as well as you would think it would from watching the movies and TVs. They've got the electric chair is known as Old Sparky, as electric chairs were often known back in those days. The prison has a terrible reputation. Sing Sing has such a bad reputation. The people in the town of Sing Sing, New York, where it's located, they changed the name of their town just so they wouldn't be associated with the prison. So Frank is really faced with two choices here. He can go to hell through Old Sparky, or he can live in hell in Sing Sing prison. And if he gets busted on first-degree murder, if he takes it with a rap on first-degree murder, it's one of those two. Either he's going to spend the rest of his life in hell, or he's going to go in hell for eternity through Old Sparky, if you get what I'm trying to say there.
All of these three people that are facing an incredible fate, they also see at the same time this woman that has been executed, and they see the photos in the newspaper.
Yeah, that is, like I was saying, that the execution in an electric chair is not a pleasant way to go. And we've got a woman there who was executed, and it was a picture in the paper, and her eyes bulging out, and it was just a horrendous way to die. And they're looking at that. So Frank is looking at that, thinking, you know, am I going to go that way? He decides that, no, he is not going to go that way. By the way, the Old Sparky that we're talking about here was actually wired by Thomas Alva Edison.
Yeah, incredible. Now, when they're talking about this plea bargain, they have to get a judge to agree to lower this first degree to second degree to be able to do this. And what is the premise of this? What does these two perpetrators say happened that night that would negate them being the cold-blooded killers that would deserve execution?
Well, this goes to the fact that they're saying that they never really wanted to kill anybody, that the bomb was supposed to go off at 2 a.m. And now we're looking at Frank, and if he's going to go up on first degree or second degree murder. And they're meeting with Judge Algernon Nova and negotiating a settlement to spare Frank's life. And all the players are there, attorneys, the biggest DAs, the chief assistant district attorney, the ADA, they're all there at this meeting. Frank's attorney maintains that although he did concoct this extortion plot, all he wanted to do was put a scare into Joseph. He had no desire to kill anyone. And if it had all gone according to plan, no one would have been hurt. That's why his attorney, Vera, is arguing today it would be unfair to charge Frank with first-degree murder and end his life on death row. And eventually, Judge Nova agrees with that argument. So Frank is going to stand before Judge Nova in County Court, Brooklyn, pleading guilty to a charge of second-degree murder, and that will be enough to spare Frank from death in the electric chair. However, he will have to do 20 years to life behind bars inside Sing Sing.
What we skipped over just a bit was a very, very interesting, I guess, evidence of the lack of loyalty between thieves and murderers, I guess, I imagine. The police find a little key on Scimone, Frank Scimone Jr., and they ask him what the key is, and he smirks.
He smirks. It's a key to the tombs. Remember Columbia Marble? They were into building mausoleums and tombstones and that kind of thing. Right. It's a key to the tombs, and he figures Frank Scimone Jr. had it in his head that he was going to kill Harry Ruisi. And probably Severa, too, his brother-in-law. He was going to kill both of them and put them in the mausoleum in the tombs, and they wouldn't be found for years. Because, like they say, three men can keep a secret if two of them are dead.
But at the same time, he smirks, and then what he finds out is that his partner also had a key as well.
Yeah, his partner, Harry, had the same plan. Harry was going to kill him and put him in the tombs, too. So these guys, that's what I'm saying. You know, there is no honor among these guys. And they all knew that the only way this secret was going to be kept is if two of them were dead.
It's very interesting that Frank Scimone Jr. gets 20 years in Sing Sing, pardon me. But this Ruisi and Savora Priori somehow get plea deals and you say walk away as free men.
They walked away free. They told, they ratted out Frank. Frank did not rat out them because they understood how this kind of thing worked, especially Harry. He understood the game. And, they ratted because the cops did tell them about the tombs idea with the keys. They said, the cops made it clear. They told everybody you were all going to kill each other. And so Harry and Severa right away, that's when they do their plea deal. And they walked away free.
What we didn't talk about was when they were looking at the Black Hand Gang to see their previous work, they also had that there was an association with one of these perpetrators to a murder of somebody named Frank Marlowe, which was, despite his name, another Italian gangster. And they just couldn't pin this murder on the suspect. But this one was another pipe bomb that also was targeted at this wealthy retired baker who refused to pay his tribute to the gang. And he was, as you write, he was mercilessly executed and he was killed right in front of his kids, right in front of his children.
Yeah, the papers back in those days, they were just filled with stories. And that's where I got this one from. They were filled with these stories of the Black Hand Gang. If you didn't respond to them, they would kill you. And they would do it in that way, in front of your family. The Black Hand Gang was a big deal back in those days. I guess there's no other way to put it.
We're also talking about how interesting it was that this extortion gang, despite all of these other murders, like I said, the similarity with the pipe bomb and the person killed in front of their children, that the courts were willing to listen to Frank Scimone Jr.'s story and dismiss this Black Hand Gang association and connection. And then also these other two, again, because of the nature of the story and how it resonated in the city, for these other two perpetrators to be able to walk away from this was very, very interesting.
Yeah, and it was, and it's funny the way it was covered in the papers back in those days. It was just a little sidebar story, just a little 2-inch story that said that they walked away. But this was the case. There was a lot of pressure to kill this to close this case. I mean, you had children killed in their kitchen. And what with a Christmas package that...
Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Exploded with a pipe bomb. There was an awful lot of pressure, as I try to describe in the book. There was a lot of pressure to get this case closed. They wanted it to go away.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. You write in conclusion that April 11th, 1932, two members of the homicide squad were praised by the commissioner Mulrooney. And condemnations were for Detective Seneff, which was the undercover cop playing Henry, and that the police said that the lessons of the arrests is that the knowledge that the police never tire in their search for criminals, and criminals are never secure against an accounting to society.
Yeah, they wrote, the fact is impressive. It's the best deterrent to crime, giving notice to criminals that events which pass from the public mind are a source of never-ending concern to the police, and the criminals are never secure against an accounting to society. That was an editorial in the Standard Union newspaper. The editorial board devoted a couple of column inches to this congratulatory message, and so the cops came out of this as heroes in this story.
Why did you choose this story, and how did you go about getting all of the pertinent information to put this story together?
Well, what I picked this story because it was so emotional. What I do, Dan, is I read through old newspapers. And if anybody's into that, newspapers.com is the place to go. And so I look through these old newspapers and I try to find time periods that are interesting. And late 1920s and early 30s are a fascinating time. And so I was looking there, and then I came across this story of three children who had been killed when a Christmas package exploded in their house. And I just kept working on it. And you read these stories, and one leads you to another. And you go down a rabbit hole, if you will, for lack of a better term. And it just became just a fascinating story to me. And then when you could see the similarities between this story and, well, Godfather 2, but also you see the attitudes of people when you look at these stories in context. You know, I mentioned a movie that was hot at the time with Spencer Tracy about how terrible Sing Sing prison was. And, you know, it's just a fascinating thing to me to find these stories and to deal with trying to express the emotions that were felt at the time.
It's so vivid, some of the revelations that you have, and some of the things that we didn't really get to talk about was this funeral with so many people in the community. It was such heartfelt outpouring of emotions in the community. And ironically, the first communion that this Mary, and it's a big deal in the Catholic Church, as people know, mm-hmm. First communion, where she was buried not long after the first communion was supposed to happen, was this same church. The same church that they were rushing to that morning, waiting for Joseph Falzone to come home and be part of this first communion, very important moment in his daughter's life. And she ends up being buried in this incredible funeral at that same church.
Yeah, the funeral itself was big news back in the day. It was covered by all the newspapers in New York. This was a story that just caught everyone's attention. And again, it's coming at a time when the world is changing. It's coming at a time when you had the Wall Street crash of October 1929. So the world is about to change. And at the same time, this other story is playing out. It just was fascinating to me.
And as you clued these other stories that happened previously, with pipe bombs, this story really galvanized the public to understand. Again, you write that the Black Hand Gang was known and people's participation in the gang was known. What was going on was well known by people. But this case, this story changed things.
Yeah, because children were killed. And it was a Christmas present disguised, a pipe bomb described as, or just disguised as a Christmas present. I mean, it just galvanized the New York community. It really did. It went outside of the Italian community in Brooklyn.
I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the murder of Mary Falzone, a shocking true crime story. For those that might want to check out your other true crime books and fictional books, where can people take a look?
Well, my website is a good place to go, rodcapley.com, or simply to Amazon. You know, everything's up on Amazon for sale.
Well, thank you so much, Rod Cackley, The Murder of Mary Falzone, a shocking true crime story. You have a great evening, and thank you so much for this interview, and good night.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.